Sarang Joshi is going to be speaking on computational anatomy. Sarang is now at Utah. He moved from North Carolina, and it's great to have him here. Thanks, Sarang.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for organizing this wonderful session. And after the talks we've seen this morning, my talk is, my life in this talk is really easy. You've covered a huge amount of material that I'll be using and building on. So although this talk I've got out this as my collaborators Tom Fletcher, who is also now at University of Utah, and my students Brad Davis and Peter Lorenzen, this really builds on everything basically that you've seen this morning, and hopefully that'll be clear. And I'm taking it slightly in a slightly different direction than what you've seen so far. And the standard typical question that we've already seen brought up today, and what I'll continue talking on, is the natural question that if you're given a large collection of anatomical images, what is the image of an average anatomy? How do we define that, and how do we estimate that? It's the kind of the problem that's really now in coming to forefront. Next thing is, if you're given a cross-sectional, this is slightly different than what you just heard in the previous talk. So you're given a cross-sectionally age-index data. So these are 100 individuals, all normals, quote-unquote normal, from Chapel Hill, that were collected over the course of 2 or 3 years, ranging in age from age 20 to about age 75. And standard kind of traditional analysis here, for example, ventricular volume, normalized by total brain volume, if you look at the trend, so this is a standard regression curve that's been fit to the ventricular volume data, you see this marked change in the ventricular volume at around age 45, steeply increasing up to age 50, 55, flattening out. And this is a well-known result in the neuroanatomy community. This is not a new result, but the question is, we can do these with nice, simple volume measurements with cross-sectional data. Can we do something with the images and really talk about what is the regression of the anatomical image as a function of index over age, modulo the population cross-sectional variation? How do we do this? Which is different than the longitudinal repeated measurements problem that you heard before. But you'll see it will be very related, it will come into play, and everything that has been talked about before. The next thing that I've been working on most recently is, how do we bring in a notion of robustness? Can we talk about robustness of estimation? Because we're basically doing statistics now, and we're doing estimation, so now immediately the question comes is, how do we introduce robust statistical descriptions that are robust to outliers and are not easily influence your measurements to outliers of the data? Because we know we're going to have it. These are large data sets. We cannot have a very clean population. We don't really even have a handle of that. So how do we bring that notion that's so popular in traditional statistics into this kind of framework? And so you'll see my attempt at it. I won't say it's... Okay. So first I'll review the mathematical framework, and you've heard a lot about this, so this will be really a review of it from the morning, and hopefully I'll give my spin on it. Then talk about average estimation via metric minimization, the Frechet mean. Then I'll talk about averaging images and application to it. Although we've applied this exact same technique to points and surfaces and curves using exactly the currents formulation that Wang Shi presented, with using measures and having measures on low-dimensional manifolds. But I'm not going to present that this. Then we'll extend that to regression for age-index anatomical imagery. And then finally, we'll talk about robust estimation via generalization of the geometric median. So that will be the basic outline of my talk. And since I'm noticing there are not much questions at the end of this session, so please feel free, if anything is not clear, to start stopping and asking questions in between. Maybe that will get questions and discussion going.
Well, are you going to go on for an hour and a half on pre-special?
No, I'm actually going to be short. That's what I'm hoping for interruptions.
Well, I'll
find
your questions for you.
Okay, so let's talk about, before we start talking about wonderful, beautiful brain imagery with functions on it and with... functional data and others, let's just consider a very simple concept. You're given a whole bunch of images of circles, and you're asked to find an average, define an average image of given a whole bunch of circles. It will be very clear in this audience that you probably don't want an image that's simply a voxel-wise average of the circles, but what you'd rather have want is the circle with an average radius. That would be the classic thing. And already we end up with an interesting space. How do we define this average? Do we define it using the arithmetic average or the geometric average of the radii? And you'll see this kind of concept will play a very important role when you start talking about defining averages for the kind of imagery and kind of data we're talking about. So we really want to talk about averages considering geometric structure. Now, the whole paradigm we've been talking about since morning, the geometric structure is characterized by transformation groups. And that really captures the geometry that's underlying it. And what we want to do is, for simple circles, you only have one parameter geometric transformation, that's namely scale. You know, all circles are basically characterized by scaling of a normal circle. And if you think about the group representation, it's simply the multiplicative group of positive reals. In that sense, then clearly the immediate metric and operation and averaging results in taking the log of the radii, averaging the logs, and then exponentiating it, which is exactly the geometric average. Now, if you're a little bit, I think it's broken.
It's stuck.
Okay. Now, for simple scale and rotation and orientation, we have finite dimensional Lie groups, you know, such as rotation, similarity transform, affine transforms, and appropriate group action and metrics defined on that. Of course, we have been talking here about high dimensional anatomical structural variation with the infinite dimensional group of diffeomorphisms. And thank you, Jonas, for really covering through the whole mathematical foundation of it. So I don't have to do it, because I probably couldn't do it as well as you did it. So definitely this is, but that's what we're going to talk about. And to review it, to remind ourselves, it's basically one-to-one onto invertible differential transformations. So they basically preserve topology, but they're very flexible. So you can actually have them deform. I don't think this is working.
I'll just run around and hold it next to your mouth. I'm sure that will work well, don't you think? Aha.
It preserves topology, and anatomical variability is understood via constructing these transformations. And this was what you saw all day today, and Laurent really made a great point about how you should think about the momenta that's conserved as you flow through these diffeomorphisms. And then the question comes in this setting is the average anatomy is basically in this framework the template estimation problem. And Stephanie is going to further talk more about this later on. So we'll see. Now why is this, again to review, this is, doing statistics on this is difficult because it's not a vector space. You cannot simply add and subtract diffeomorphisms. They have a form nice group structure. And the composition is the standard operation. Now, when people do statistics on deformation fields directly, you're basically doing a small deformation kind of approximation or linear elastic approximation in which you assume everything is close to the identity where everything looks flat, and you can do your additions and subtractions and all the standard statistics. Now, the great thing that has emerged throughout the morning is even though it's an infinite dimensional group, it's very close to a Lie group in the sense that there's a tangent space, the space of all smooth vector valued velocity fields. And that's what the inner product that Laurent defined on these vector fields. And we can construct diffeomorphisms by integrating flows of velocity fields and induce an appropriate metric by defining a Sokolov norm, which he was enforcing it on via the kernel K, on the space of velocity fields. So once you have done that, now where do images come into play? Now this is where we are going to slightly actually, I'm going to follow Laurent's book, in which he didn't mention in his talk about metamorphosis, where the images are functions in the underlying coordinate system, and the space of diffeomorphisms act on them via the group operation. And you can define a semi-direct product space, which is a semi-direct product of L2, which is a space of images, via on omega and diffeomorphisms of omega. And so this combined gives you kind of the full space I would like to think that we want to work in, and define statistics on that combined semi-direct product space. Now, given that, now how do we define averaging? Let's start with defining averaging, and then we'll get more complicated from that. Now, first thing is we're going to generalize the notion of Fréchet mean by using the term notion of Fréchet mean. And think about averaging in Euclidean space. I mean, in Euclidean space, the mean can be defined as a minimum mean squared error minimizer. Except now that we don't have induced by a Euclidean norm. So rather than using a Euclidean norm, we actually minimize the squared distance and define your average image as that image that minimizes sum of squared distances between an image sitting at identity and an image and along with all these transformations, diffeomorphic transformations associated with that. And this is where the full metric structure would be that I'm proposing to use an approximation of it. You'll see we use both the true metamorphosis structure that Laurent and Alan have introduced in this framework to define the average image. And what that means is, once we have that, we need a metric on diffeomorphisms, which is defined via, you've already seen these exact equations, that defines distance, a right invariant distance between any two diffeomorphisms. Once we have that, we can define the least energy minimization as minimizing the image over an image and all the transformations associated with all the n images, which minimizes this joint metric. Now this, let me warn you, and I think Stephanie is going to elaborate more on this, is this formulation in which you're jointly minimizing the image and all the deformations, it's not a consistent estimator for large deformations, because note, if our aim is only to estimate the image I hat, phi I's are in some sense a nuisance variable. They're not the variables that you want to really care about, because your problem is to estimate I. And in statistics, if you have nuisance variables, you need to integrate over them, over the entire space of all of those nuisance variables. And this is what I think Dr. Miller is also mentioning about the EM, in which you're actually trying to integrate over them. Now, for reasonable noise, in practice, the mode approximation to the expectation works pretty well, and we can really get away with this, and unless the noise levels are really large. But in this setting, we can do this, and then what this means is...
But the issue here, just...
Yes.
Since we haven't talked about your paper from 2004, which your colleague referenced yesterday, so it was nice that you weren't here, but I stopped using it. So the issue is, whether you were estimating I or not, that as the population size goes to infinity, in this setting, the problem is there are as many phis are going as population number.
Yes.
You know, because you're not integrating out that nuisance.
Exactly. That's the issue.
Right. So,
right.
So what you'd like is, as population size gets large, you're still only estimating one deformation of the template, not n, where n goes to infinity. And that's really what you're
I think that's with all, the whole notion of why you need to integrate.
What you're finding practically, just so I understand, is that if the noise between your observable and the image is small, what you see is that's not a problem?
That's not a problem. I mean, you can do this very simply, even with just simple translations. Forget about the complex diffeomorphisms and all that. Just take a 1D image, and the only group operation you're operating on is, say, a periodic translation. And you'll see that just if you do this kind of mode approximation, it works great as long as the noise level is low. But after a certain noise level, no matter how many samples you put into it, it will not converge to the true kind of estimate that you have.
Sorry for saying that.
No, that's great. Okay, so we can do this, and this is the basic kind of computational framework that you end up having. And You are, now the interesting thing is this, now we've turned this into an N4 joint minimization problem. Luckily, and you can think, you know, the original diffeomorphic landmark matching, diffeomorphic matching problem is a pretty computationally intensive problem, but it turns out when you formulate it like this and do little this kind of formulation, you can really have a nice and fast and efficient augmenting algorithm. Because if you think about it, if I fix all the fees, so I'm assuming that now I'm doing an alternating kind of a gradient alternating method, I fix all the fees, then all of your the minimization problem with respect to I is a simple minimum mean squared error problem whose average, whose mean is exactly just the average image that has been deformed. Now if I fix I hat, this problem completely decouples into n independent deformation problems. So it's beautifully parallelizable. So you can basically alternate until convergence of this alternating algorithm and have a very efficient, fast computational method. And now we have this whole thing implemented on a graphics hardware. For about $600, you can buy a graphics card nowadays and put multiple of them, so ideally you can just stack up 50, 100 of them and do them in parallel, and the whole thing really works, and now it's really, it's not a problem anymore to talk about processing hundreds of images. This is not, you don't need supercomputers and to do all this. Which,
is V1 VI?
Oh, sorry, that's supposed to be VI. Sorry, thank you. That's VI. Yes. Now, here's an example. We will visit these simple examples throughout. So here's an example, a little bit more complicated than a circle, not much more complicated, where we have a bunch of bullseye. So these are 16 bullseye images in which they are not simply a scale version of each other. So now there are three different circles going on here. So there's not a single scale parameter that you can average either geometrically or arithmetically to get a thing. And here's an example of what happens. We're just going to run the algorithm. And what you notice is all the bullseyes deforming simultaneously, rather pretty fast, to a nice, simple, good bullseye, and really converging to an average bullseye image. And it works with reasonable noise, I said, and most of the time in medical imaging right now, for beautiful MR images, you've been seeing them over and over again, this kind of noise, although the noise is much more visible on the computer than on the screen, it's not really a problem. Now, when you really increase the noise in which you cannot see the image at all, then you end up having a issue of consistency. So, and here's a, now a result in which what I've done is I've numerically calculated the geometric average of all the n bullseyes, of all the individual three circles that represented the bullseyes, and overlaid on the calculated bullseye image. And you see it matches really well. Now, let me warn you, there's no reason that this actually matches. I mean, mathematically, you cannot prove that the individual radii averages to come close to the this kind of average defined this way. Okay, now this is an application that we can apply this to brain images. It actually works. And I think Guido presented a lot of results by applying this exact methodology to real data, so I'm not going to go through that application. Okay, so now let's get to the next interesting problem, which is, that was fine for given an atomic collection of images, there's no particular independent variable that's indexed by it, they're all kind of equally drawn from the same population, and we all get great shape. But how do we do it if we're given, and here, for example, an age-indexed population? Clearly, averaging all of these by, you know, whatever method, like what I mentioned earlier, into one group template. I think that's what Wang Qi and Dr. Miller were talking about, of different templates. It clearly is not going to work. So now what do we do? So let's review how I generated the blue graph first. Because that's what we'll first understand how we do it in Euclidean space and try and generalize the exact same technique in this more complex setting. So classic, and this is a real review back from the, I think, 60s or 50s, if you think about kernel regression, that was exactly how the blue curve was generated, is that if you give a set of observations, ti, where ti is the time index, yi is your response variable, and you say there's some function y of ti, which is a function m of ti plus some measurement noise, You can define an estimator of y m of t, and one way to define it is that the conditional expectation of y as a random variable y given for time t. So that's how you define your unknown function m of t. Now, if you can write this simply as the expectation over the joint densities of y and t, assuming these that y and t are related, divided by the conditional the marginal density of the your response variable time here t, which is real now, and then the Nadarayya-Watson kernel regression estimation replaces these unknown densities via kernel density estimates. And if you use the kernel density estimates with particular bandwidths g and h for these two random variables, y and ti, so you define it like this, you end up getting, and something very interesting happens, assuming that the kernel is symmetric about yi, what it turns out happening is your kernel density estimator simply becomes a weighted average of your observations yi. And the kernel integrates out that's over the variable yi. So it doesn't matter what bandwidth you pick, and you're only left with a single bandwidth choice h. And you can define this. And this is exactly what was done to generate this blue line. It's a simple kernel regression. And it's basically a moving weighted average weighted by a kernel. That's all we're doing. Now, I spent my last half of the talk talking about averaging. Now we've got a notion of regression and moving window averaging, so we can just put the two together and define. So if you're given any Riemannian manifold with a metric, we can define condition a regression curve on this manifold by defining it as a minimizer of a weighted least squares, where the weight is given by kernels of particular bandwidth s on your response variable ti. So you're given any, and this can be done, it's completely generally defined on any manifold, in which you can, what you're doing is you're generating a moving average at each point, weighted, and the distance is being weighted by the distance of the kernel. Now, clearly, for Gaussian kernel, it really goes off to all the points, but we truncate after three standard deviations, so it becomes rather kind of a local. Now, you don't have to use a Gaussian kernel, but, and you end up getting a moving average kind of kernel, and here's the actual result now of applying this to the data set I showed you, in which we are now regressing the image, the average image at each dense time point t. Then now you can clearly see the ventricles growing, the CSF areas in the cortical surfaces thickening. And now this is at now every time point. It doesn't matter what your original data lived on. And here's some of the results. So here's an example of, I think, at age 35 and age 55. So I've just taken snapshots out of that movie. And now you can clearly see, look at the changes in the ventricular sizes that were shown by the blue curve. Now this is regressing images. We have not yet linked them all together. And this is where Wang Shi's dense diffeomorphism approach for growth modeling really comes into play. Because now we can stuff this kind of modeling within the dense flow field estimation problem. And that's precisely, well, these are some more results that I've shown now, female age 30, 60, and female and male. We've done this independently now for two populations, males and females. So we subdivided the populations.
Well, there's still a lot of brain there.
There is, luckily, yes. Okay, so now we come, and now how do we actually link all these images together and really talk about the average growth pattern? Now we can do that is, now we talk about, this is exactly the growth model, in which now you don't have time points at discrete time, but at continuous time along this regression path. And now you've got, now instead of this just being at the endpoint matching problem, you have the continuous matching problem, but the exact same formulation. Now this is, now here t is real time. This is real age. This is not just simulation time to generate diffeomorphic flows. But the exact same thing in which we take I hat is replaced by this estimator. And once you do that, and now the great thing is, and I'm so glad that Laurent talked so much about parallel transport, because now that you've calculated this diffeomorphism in this flow, you can use parallel transport to then apply to any individual brain and move that forward and think is to, as an estimate of how that particular individual will differ based on an average trait. So this is kind of how the thing, we haven't done that yet, but I'm digesting the whole, all the equations that Laurent has derived. We'll get it done soon. So here are some of the results of actually now calculating what just for the average growth model and looking at the Jacobian of the local deformation between the time points and the local velocity fields and seeing how it really grows over time.
So you, I'm not sure I understand. So if we go back to the previous, so you've implemented the time series
yes.
problem where you generated the vector field associated with time series data.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Yes, I mean, Faisal had it in his display for landmarks.
Yeah,
I
had it in the
other. Exactly.
Where is that now? Was this yet in a paper? I mean, are you good?
Yeah, this is in the it's in the IJCV paper that's submitted, and it's in the ICCV paper that won the best paper award.
Right, I know the regression is, but the time series also that you implemented?
We just referenced your paper and wrote down the Euler branch. I mean, it's,
okay.
Yeah. Yes, so it's in your.
That's what you were. Did you recite?
No.
he might be at the next talk you give. Okay, that's a good
question.
Yeah.
So once we have the I hat T.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Because now you have a density index time.
Well, I guess Anchi have the free inverse.
Oh, yeah, I did. I have free inverse, yes.
But also, Anchi did the point version.
Yes, he did the point version.
Anchi did the point version. And this is more the dense image version, which Faisal, I know, has published on or has done. Am I right? This is the dense image?
Yeah, this is the dense image version. There's no landmark points here. No.
See this?
Did you also write, you had the equation for the dense image?
Well, I did.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
Right, but we hadn't implemented it yet. Now Faisal's been doing it.
Oh, yeah, no, this has been implemented. I mean, Brad did it. Brad implemented it. And so here are the results when we look at the Jacobian of the transformation. Okay, so now we come with now, but still, so very real statistics. From real statistics, you want d values. And t-tests, that's real statistics. So far, we're talking about estimators. And so bandwidth selection and significance of trend. So this is an example, and this is where we are starting. We're trying to get this, and this is why we've developed a graphics card implementation and our graphics card cluster. Because what you want to be able to do is, really, what is the significance of one of the things you want is, what is the significance of the trend you have found? Is there a real trend? Yes, you can always find a trend. You pick appropriate bandwidth, you find some trend and some curve, but what is the statistical significance of that trend? So the first immediate question is, and this is what's done now and traditionally in scalar statistics, is first hypothesis, the null hypothesis that x and y are independent. So the null hypothesis is that there is no dependence on age on the shape of your brain. Then you realize that any reordering of the images should result in an equally likely regression curve, because you're saying they're independent. Now what you can do is really calculate the distance squared, the actual residue, for a whole bunch of random reorderings of your data set, calculate regression curve, and for each one and for different bandwidths, so you can get an idea of how fast the curve is also moving, a p-value by generating the null hypothesis residues for all these independent. And here's an example. This is actually done for a simple toy example. We are still far from actually doing it with the exact brain image data set, because as you can imagine, doing 500,000 permutations of full growth model on 100 data sets, yes, it's doable, but it's still, it's work to be done. And here's an example of what happens in which you've got a bandwidth selection kernel here, and this really picks out the bandwidth over which you have significance of trend of your data, where these things are correlated. And that's a way that really talks about what is the significant rate of change in years or in age of your brain images, in some sense. And here's now the other thing is now we can do is group comparisons in the same formulation. Are the females changing compared to the male cohort? Again, applying the exact same permutation ideas that people have used for scalar regressions, that they go right through, in which now here the permutations are not across the time axis, but across the group permutations. And that gives you now a way to generate statistically significant significance of the difference that you see in whatever you're measuring. And so this is a way to differentiate statistically the male and female cohort. Although in this case, you can clearly see, and it's also well known in the literature, that there is a difference. Okay, now robustness. How do we now move to generalizing these that I've been talking so far and make these kind of statements robust outliers? Now, again, my title of my talk is Simple Statistics, so we're going to do very simple things. And the first simple thing that comes in for robustness is median versus mean. So the mean so let's just review this in RN, where everything is very familiar and very simple, and then see how we can move forward. So in mean versus median, in simple RN, the mean is given as by a least squares problem. It is a nice closed form solution given by the arithmetic average. Now the median, on the other hand, is defined by the geometric median, not the discrete median. The geometric median is defined by that minimizes the L1 norm and can be defined as minimizing the absolute value. And there's no closed form solution for this in RN. But you know, we didn't have a closed form solution for the mean, so it shouldn't matter too much that we have no closed form solution for the median. So, and here's an example where you see robustness immediately in RN, it's simply in R2. And by the way, there's a beautiful Java applet on the web that really can play with random points, move them around, and see really the robustness of the geometric median versus the mean. And here's an example. So here we have a bunch of outliers. This is kind of, you can think of the main lobe of the data. And you notice that these things really start pulling immediately the mean away from the median, versus the median really stays stabilized. And you can really see if you drag all the points off really far, that the mean will just really go off. And that's really quantified by a notion of breakdown point of an estimator. Now for a median, it's about 50%, and so up to 50% of data can go off to infinity, and still the median will remain finite. Well, the mean, the breakdown point is zero, even if one data point goes up to infinity. Now that's going to be interesting, because we'll have problems trying to define such notions of robustness for what we're doing, but that's what makes it interesting. Okay, so now in RN, we have a nice simple gradient descent algorithm, which is originally proposed by Weisfeld in 1937, and later on modified with with Ostrich in 1978. And it's simply a weighted least squares averaging algorithm that converges for steps of alpha between 0 and 2. So you simply do a weighted least squares averaging to generate. And you have to include singular points where the median, and you can actually, if the xi exactly matches one of the median points. Now we have this. We can now directly define this on manifolds. So if you have a general Riemannian manifold, you can actually define the geometric median, very straightforward, as not the minimizer of squared distances, but the minimizer of the distance itself, up to xi. And so assuming that you have some convex subset of your manifold in which the data point lives in, which has some diameter d, we're going to define d, and all the data points don't live in a single geodesic, because if they all live in a single geodesic, you have a problem of what the next theorem says. You can actually define and write down a real theorem that says when is the weighted geometric median exists and is unique. So we can directly define weighted geometric median, because we know we want to do regression, we want to do weighted averaging. So weighted geometric median exists and is unique if, and this is where the Jacobi fields and understanding sectional curvature of these manifolds is really important. And David Mumford and his students have been really working hard in trying to do this. So if the sectional curvature of the manifold M are bounded above, and your diameter is less than, by some delta, and the diameter is less than pi over 2 over the square root of delta, then it's unique. Or if they're non-negative, then it's unique. And the proof directly follows from simple argument about convexity of Riemannian distance. And these are identical conditions that ensure that the Frochet mean or the Karcher mean also exists. So there's nothing, it's really rather straightforward, but it's good to see that. Now coming back to robustness, I mentioned the breakdown point is percentage of points that can be moved to infinity before your statistics goes to infinity. Now for the Euclidean mean it's zero, while for the geometric median is 50%. Now, how do we generalize this to manifolds? I mean, clearly, for compact manifolds, this doesn't make sense. Because, on a compact manifold, you cannot have a point going off to infinity. So, what do we want to mean by robustness? I mean, and I really don't know. I mean, we have not been able to formulate that. But one of the things, I'll still show you some examples from compact manifolds that really shows how the median is more robust. So the generalizing this, so let me first give you the exact algorithm that we have for Weissmann algorithm on the manifolds. Is simply if you're given some current estimate m of k, you define the new estimate m of k as an exponentiation of a velocity field at the tangent space at m of k, where the velocity field is given by the average normalized kind of log of the pullback of the log map of each of the data points at that point mk. And it's the exact simple thing, and this the theorem is that similar to the Weissfeld algorithm in Neutrino space, that for alpha between 0 and 2, this and if the sectional curvatures of m are non-negative, then the existence uniqueness condition are satisfied, then this algorithm will actually converge to the true mean as k goes to infinity. So we have that same kind of convergence theorem for Weissfeld on an arbitrary manifold.
So Ron, yeah. M, what is M?
M is your current estimate
of
the median.
Of the median.
Right.
What is log sub M sub k, what does that mean?
That is the log map and the tangent space at mk, at the current mk.
So for us, the median is a template.
Yes.
Right, so that's what you mean.
That's what you mean, yeah. So it's the log of all your data points xi brought back to the current estimate at mk. And I think I have a nice, I had a nice graphics that shows how you bring, you shoot from your current estimate and get the momentum. So, okay, so explicitly in this framework, you've got a current estimate of your template. You shoot your thing, you calculate your momentum there. Now, you average the momentum, but weighted by the distances, not just flat averaging. Then shoot forward with alpha equals 2 up to that. And then go from there, but keep doing a weighted average.
The log can't give you momentum. That doesn't give you momentum.
It gives you, it gives you velocity.
The left side is vector field.
Sorry, yes.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. Yeah,
I know.
But that's what you mean.
That's what I mean, yeah. Okay, so here's an example. Now, this all works really beautifully in simple.
Good question. Theorem gives you.
Ooh, good question. No, the Weissfeld converges really fast. It's a good thing that should be explored. I'm sure people have beaten the Weissfeld algorithm to death, so we'll have to lift that up to and see what conditions required for manifold case. But the Weissfeld algorithm is very fast. I mean, usually two or three iterations, boom, it just converges. So, example. Let's start with simple rotations. So here are I'm representing simple rotations via the frame associated with them. So these are very small, simple, nice rotations all packed together. And we're going to throw in some outliers which are off by 90 degrees, rotate by 90 degrees, and throwing them and averaging them using this. And you notice as you have, this is 0, 5, 10, 15 outliers, as you start throwing in outliers, the mean really starts tilting because of the influence of the outliers. Well, you notice the median really stays nice and robust. But although, you know, with rotations, you want a compact group, so there's no real notion of robustness in terms of things going off to infinity. But it seems to behave robustly, so we have to think about other definitions of robustness. Mm. The next thing is, you know, we can do the exact same thing with projective Kendall shape spaces, in which you've got now a set of 18 hands shaped images, and we're going to throw in some real outliers, just random ellipses drawn from it, and then see how this happens. And this is really dramatic. It's wonderfully, the median is wonderfully robust, and the mean really goes off. Within, you know, with 12 outliers, the mean doesn't look anywhere near like a hand-shaped figure, while the median really stays very stable. And now finally, getting back to metamorphosis, this is the latest results, in which we can do the exact same thing. Now, this is different than the averaging metric, exactly what I was looking at. This is exactly implementing, actually, the metamorphosis of Truve and Yunus, and in which we look at these kind of examples where we have these three bullseye and outlier ellipse, and look at the influence of the outlier ellipse on the averages defined on the metamorphosis group. And here you notice, it's subtle. I mean, that's one of the things we're trying hard time with metamorphosis in the images, is to really see the effect of outliers on the mean, on the with the shapes and rotations. It was really easy to see the breakdown of and the effect of robustness. But here, what we can do is we can really quantify it in terms of the kind of elongateness or the ellipticality of the resulting estimates. And here we notice in the mean, the ratio of the vertical to the horizontal is like 1.13, while the median is very close to 1.04. And you know, you had all the three circles should have one. So that's how we see really the robustness coming into this into play over here as well. So,
did you try to change the curves, for example, in the outliers?
Change what?
Change the curves that don't have the same order of colors.
Really? Not in the same. No, no, we didn't do that.
Because that would.
That's a good idea. That, but you see, yeah, the thing is, we really want to emphasize the shapes part in the metamorphosis anyway.
So why are you doing these silly ellipses? I mean, you did something just now that's potentially incredible, and you're doing this crazy bullseye nonsense. Go to, I mean, you've got all sorts of data where there are presumably subpopulations, right?
Yeah.
You now have a way of saying that this thing that lives outside, you know, I mean, I have millennials that have something that's really different in shape space. You're telling us, you have a way of basically saying that this thing is far and your median isn't going to feel it. So why don't you do something?
No,
keep going. I mean, you know.
Yeah, of course. This is part of the press. No, I have no intentions of stopping at ellipses. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
You know, you're talking about a 10-year program. We're on a 10-year program here. You know.
Sorry. Keep going.
No, that's yeah. No, that's pretty much it. So
okay.
Yeah. So no, the next step is to really apply this. No, I mean the thing is. First, I mean, the reason for ellipses is to make sure it works for ellipses, because if you just show brains, I have no real idea of what it means to be an outlier brain. Is everyone in this room an outlier of the population, or, you know?
Thank you, sir. There must be 100 questions. Any questions?
Yeah, more than Mark.
Yeah.
Of course, if you have points going to infinity, that's
But if you take the sensitivity to the tail of the distribution, don't you think we could have a correct definition even?
Yes, but that's a very distribution-based approach. But if you think about non-distribution, kind of just I'm uncomfortable going down distribution-based approach because distributions on these spaces and all that. I mean, especially when you go to diffeomorphisms and all. I don't know how to define measures yet on the entirety of diffeomorphisms. Now I don't know how to do integration on this space. So that's why I'd rather stay distribution free.
Yeah, but if you take the distribution of the distance with respect to the mean of your template, then you can still talk about the tail of phase distribution.
Yeah, I think yeah.
Try some
no, absolutely no. That's probably a good yeah. But something has to be done. I haven't seen anyone actually ever talk about this. So you're right. No, but we need to. I think that might be a really good idea. You're right, because that is really what it means to go off to infinity. You're really looking at the tails.
I think I had a question kind of along the same lines. On a manifold, one of the things you can do is local analysis. Could you infer anything? But in terms of your definition of robustness between the mean and the median, if you do local analysis around the identity in terms of sensitivity to small perturbations where you have a lot of local group theory that you can apply locally, or is that sort of precisely such a tail-based effect that you're after that local analysis would fail to inform you in any way?
That's an interesting. Yeah, I have to think about that. No, I haven't thought about it, like trying to do a local analysis.
I mean, local analysis on manifold always is a little tricky because there are things that really only show up.
Exactly.
Global structure, but other things you can infer, and I'm wondering if this might be one.
It might be. I mean, yeah, no, this is really, it's pretty hard on the express, and Tom and I have been, going back and forth trying to really figure this out, so. Any comments are really welcome. So unfortunately, I don't have much. Yeah, but no, both Xavier Yeo's and some kind of this analysis is definitely required. I mean, so it needs to be this. It really needs to be done to figure out what robustness. How do you want to define robustness? Yeah.
So can you go back to the slide where you had the hands and the circles?
Yes. Yeah.
How do you define outliers? Because is it the number of points you have, the more.
No.
If you take median, right, then maybe if the hands were the outliers, the median is so much away from the actual. If you reverse suppose the ellipses were the right one, the hands were the outliers. So how do you define an outlier here? Give some information to the algorithm that this is an outlier and this is not.
Oh no, there's no information given to the algorithm. No, the algorithm is simply the median calculation on exactly the Kendall shape space. The complex projective space, which is the space of correspondence landmarks mod rotation and scale. So it's really, you pump the whole thing directly into it. There is nothing else. It's simply the median computation algorithm. So nothing gets tagged. There's nothing. There's no outlier detection. There's no outlier, any of these kind of things. So yeah. So if you have more ellipses in the end, I forget what are the exact numbers we have here. If you have a huge number of ellipses that are all closed, like just put a single circle. So really. Then yeah, of course, then your hands will be, your median will be, and the mean will be the circle. And it will not feel the notion, the issue of the hand.
So the number of similar shapes that
might I mean, it's the exact same thing as, in the Euclidean case, where if you have two populations, then, as long as.
Right, I'm not sure, because Euclidean is translation invariant, so.
Maybe
you need much more ellipses than hands. To really twist the balance. It would be interesting to measure that.
Yeah, that you're right about translation invariant.
Because of the template. Well,
yeah.
Any more questions? John.
Going back to a few slides earlier, how do you define the width and the smoothing threshold?
Ah!
And how do you modify it depending on how many subjects you have?
Yes!
Because if you've got a lot more subjects, you probably smooth.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that's why I talked about the, there's, how did we actually do it for the result I did, and how, or how would I like to do it?
How would you like to do it?
This is how I would like to do it. But actually, because when you're talking about, if you have a response variable and a vector variable, and you're talking about kernel, then you need to, you can only talk about dependence at a particular banner. Because if you make the kernel really tiny, you'll always, things will always thing, and if you get the kernel really broad, you'll never see any difference.
Is there no way to regularize it?
The most, in Euclidean space, so we went in the literature, so we have, what could people do in Euclidean space? And we have a really great collaborator, Steve Maron, who is really great, but he's a real thought-holding statistician, but he has a great sense of humor. So, he has worked, and you'll get to this, because we, is, the thing to do is what people usually do is cross-validation. You know, you do leave one out kind of studies, and you minimize residue to what you've left out for varying bandwidths, or, but if you're really looking for significance, you know, which is what the medical imaging community really likes, is then you want to do is what is the the significance of your thing, but then real statisticians will have a problem because you're optimizing over significance with respect to your kernel. So, you know, so yeah, this is, these are issues, but this is basically this kind of way I would like to do it, in which you define a significance level at a bandwidth. So you don't look at just one, but you look at this, and here you can clearly see this cliff falling off, then you're in good shape. You know, but if you plot this and then you luck, you know, you've got a little blip here for that exact bandwidth, you have a problem with your data.
But suppose you've got, you know, much more sparsely sampled data, say the age range from 90 to 120, you don't have as many subjects, which is very typical.
Yeah.
Can you adjust the...
Well, no, but then I would go parametric. Whenever you have sparse data, you want to go parametric. You know, I mean, the thing is, you really want to go parametric and then do a single geodesic or fit a straight line. You know, when you have two or three data points, you...
Okay. Just finish your sentence.
Yeah. So when you have very sparse data, you don't want to do it non-parametric. You want to do it parametrically. And here then it will be how you fit a single geodesic. I've been working on that, and that's why you really need the Jacobi fields. So
why don't you pick that up with Jonathan?
Yeah.
Thank you for the questions. I hope you're all enjoying this as much as I am. I did want to make one announcement. So in order to have a session at IPAN, which we're lucky to have today, you have to have a winner of the prize, the Mar Prize. Now, yesterday we heard about a winner of the Mar Prize, and Sir Armin's also a winner of the Mar Prize. So the only reason we're having this session today is because we could find him, get him to work on diffeomorphisms for a few weeks, and he agreed to do this. So thanks, Sir Armin.